Station number 26947.
To Jarvis, rail 6. We're talking about your time at RAF Shepden, Shobden, sorry, which was about 2 weeks of training on the lighter Hotspur gliders. Now, what happened then? What was your next move?
I was transferred to RAF Brasenorton to the heavy glider conversion unit, and then undertook.
Did it have a number, or was it just the only
I
one?
can't remember, but I think it probably was the only one, yes.
And that's still in October, you'd think.
Absolutely, yeah.
And what happened when you got there?
Well, I then teamed up with a co-pilot and was trained on Horsa glider and Wecos, which the RAF called Hadrians, and American gliders.
Now,
So,
what was the difference between them?
well, it's just the RAF name was a Hadrian. The Wecko
No,
was
the holes
American.
are
The
the.
Horsa, well, it was a very large glider, capable of carrying 26 fully armed troops and ammunition. But the Wecko or Hadrian, that was a much smaller glider, capable of carrying no more than about a dozen troops.
Now, what were the characteristics of that? Well, the Horsa, that was the one you were actually on. So this is the
That's
most.
right.
Well, can you describe it in as much detail as possible, as far as you remember, what it was like?
Well, it was quite a huge glider, contrary to what a lot of people believe when you talk about gliders, because the wingspan was almost as large as a Lancaster bomber, and that puts it in perspective. But to actually, the access was gained by a door on the port side, just behind the cockpit, and seats on either side of the fuselage extended from front to back, with obviously belts that the airborne troops actually sat on. The cockpit comprised, well, let's say there were two pilots, as normal. The first pilot was on the port side, and the co-pilot was on the starboard side. There was a small connecting door between the cockpit and the main fuselage.
Now, what about the Hadrian or the Wacker, whatever
Yes, a medium-sized glider, that's a capacity, I'd say, about a dozen troops. And the main difference between it was the Horsa was virtually all wooden construction. The Hadrian was tubular metal construction, strange it may seem, and with fabric covering. It was an American production. And again, facilities for two pilots. I think from an aerodynamic angle, the main difference was that the Horsa had huge flaps like barn doors, where the Hadrian, Wacko, that they had spoilers on the wing. It was a high wing glider, and the spoilers virtually acted as flaps in a normal conventional aircraft.
Now, what were the actual processes of taking off and landing in the Horsa, for instance? Did it differ from the small glider you'd trained on
Well,
previously?
largely because the tug aircraft was much more powerful, and we were flown towed by Whitley bombers and Albemarle twin-engine bombers, and also the Wacko cum Hadrian. They were towed by the same tug aircraft.
And was the release mechanism the same?
Yeah, virtually pulling a lever, that's all.
And anything happened while you were there? How did you take to these larger gliders? Any problems?
Not really. The Horsa had a tricycle, well, both of them had a tricycle undercarriage, which I hadn't been used to before, because I've only flown aircraft with three wheels for three-point landing. But however, very quickly adapted to that and converted onto these gliders without a great deal of problem at all.
Were there any accidents or incidents during the training process?
Oh yeah, a number of crews did come to grief, but in particular doing night flying, because obviously being towed by a tug in the dark is not the easiest of things.
But what are the problems? Explain them.
You fly normally in the high toe. That is mean that you're higher than the tug, looking down on it. And bear in mind it's dark, and you're talking about 200 or 300 feet, the length of the cable. The tug becomes then simply a silhouette. And you've got to make certain you keep yourself in station. And unfortunately, I think one or two people came to grief and then they crashed. Either they went too high and caused the tug aircraft to stall, or some problem arose. As a result, they actually did crash, and there was a loss of life.
But you had no...
No, I had no... Bear in mind, the power training I'd had in America, etc., these I found were comparatively easy to fly.
Now, were you being formed into crews with your co-pilot at this time, or were you still just training randomly?
No, we were formed into crews with flying instructors, obviously, ensuring that we're able to convert onto these gliders without any problem.
No, I mean, did you get a regular pilot?
Oh, I did. I had a second pilot. Peter Geddes, his name was.
Can you tell us about him? What was he like as a chap and as a co-pilot?
Well, strange it may seem, he trained at the same school as I did in America, at No. 4 BFTS. And we were both sergeants, and to this day, I don't know how they chose who was to be the first pilot or the second pilot, but it's simply we were told what position we were going to take, and I happened to be a first pilot, and he happened to be a second pilot. He was equally good a pilot as I was, because he got his wings trained the same place that I did.
And what was he like?
A stocky man. He came from Elgin. A pure Scottish person, difficult to understand because of his dialect. On the radar, it was horrendous, people to try to understand him. But a thoroughly nice guy, he really was.
You actually were friends with him as well?
Oh, yes, a friendship had to develop while we were training, and also while we were on the operation.
Now, what was the role of the co-pilot? I mean, you were flying. What was he doing?
Well, he was largely just sitting there throughout all the exercises. But the point being, obviously, under operational conditions, if I was injured or killed, he would immediately take over.
And so he didn't have a role, really, other than replacing you if you were
absolutely,
ill.
Absolutely.
Or more to the point.
Absolutely, that's quite true.
And there were no other members of the crew? That was
no, just the two of us.
Now, how long were you at Bryce Norton?
About a fortnight.
So that'd take you to November, probably, 44.
Could be, yes.
So what happened then?
Then we were allocated to squadrons. And the glider pilot regiment have squadrons alphabetically placed. And I was in E squadron.
E,
that's right.
So where were they based?
At Downempney near Swindon.
And what were your first impressions? So you joined them around about November 1944?
Yes. Yes, about that time. And then we met up with the glider pilot regiment administrative staff and the remnants of the army glider pilots who had survived the ill-fated operation at Arnhem.
And how did you fit in? What was your reception like from them? How did you know?
A little strange at first.
In what way?
Well, they were army people. We were RAF people, and our way of life was rather different because the army pilots were basically soldiers and highly qualified soldiers. But they had been selected for pilot training on gliders. And those who had passed the course then had the dual ability. But we were pure RAF pilots and knew very little about the military side.
Did they make you welcome?
Oh, yes, indeed. Very quickly. Yeah, very quickly. We merged in as a group very quickly.
How was the squadron, E squadron, organised? I mean, how many...
You had a commanding officer, an adjutant, and... a handful of officers, who were virtually the flight commanders, and the flights were there were about four flights, as I remember, and largely army captains. They were the flight commanders, and some, but not necessarily in East Gordon, some were RAF flight lieutenants. So they assumed some of the responsibility.
And what about any key figures in your? I mean, I don't, which flight were you in?
I can't read. To be honest, I can't remember the flights.
And do you
there
remember,
were about four.
Do you remember any key figures? I mean, like the commanding officer.
Oh yeah, commanding officer was Major Jackson.
Do you know his first name?
I don't offhand. No, it's a long
and
time
what
ago.
Was he like?
He was a typical army officer. But the fact he was, it was a glider pilot also, he was able to associate with us as RAF pilots. But one always got the impression that with army pilots, they tend to feel they're a little bit, let's say, inferior because of their training. And their training was only basic with regard to flying, but ours was extremely comprehensive, obviously. You always had that feeling. But it soon disappeared. And I, as I remember, by the way, his name has now come back, it was Peter Jackson.
And what was he like as a CO?
Let me see, robust, a bit ebullient. I can't really say much more than that. I had nothing against myself. He was a thoroughly nice person.
Any of the other officers stick in your mind? Your flight officer or your...
No, I can't really. I can't remember the other ones, no.
And so what happened then? You were, what were you doing while you were at...
Well, we were training, undertaking specific intense military training, because remember, as RAF pilots, we barely knew the barrel end from the butt end of a gun.
So tell us about the military training.
Well, I used to go on commando courses and long marches, usual basic military training, really, as far as being an infantryman was concerned, which you'll appreciate, it came quite strange to us.
And did you find it hard then?
Not really, no.
Was there a lot of weapons training?
Or... Yes, quite a lot.
Which weapons?
Well, use your rifle, rifles, Bren guns, Sten guns, Piat, anti-tank weapons. Largely, well, we didn't undertake any heavy weapons. They were largely hand weapons.
And what about, were you doing tactical exercises then?
Yes, we were.
Do you remember what form they took?
Well, it's simply a question of one team virtually trying to engage another team under various circumstances.
Would you actually practice landing the glider with a body of troops aboard, or was that not practical?
No, strange it may seem, we always had empty gliders with ballast on board to obviously create a similar situation as with troops. But I never did fly a glider with troops in up to the time that I went on Operation Varsity. It's the first time ever.
Was that simply in case something went wrong, do you think?
I don't really know. I mean, would have been perfectly capable of flying troops, as was proven at the operation. But I just don't think that they wished to involve the airborne troops during our particular training. I think that's all it was.
So they didn't practice landing and then doing what they did from a glider. That was the first time they did it, was when they did it in action.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Any other elements of the training you were undergoing?
Well, we did obviously day flying and night flying. That was quite comprehensive. We used to have what we called remote releases, where you would be taken up about 3,000 or 4,000 feet, then released from the tug aircraft, or you release yourself, about 7 or 8 miles away. Then you had to glide down and judge in the dark where you were, get into position and land successfully on the airfield concerned. That wasn't particularly easy, I must admit, as you had no engines and you couldn't go around again.
Anything else about the training?
I don't really think so. I think that broadly covers it.
Now, what about that? When did you find out about the operation you were going to be on? What briefing did you have before it?
Well, we realised the operation had been delayed because this was going to take place at the latter part of 1944, and not long after the Arnhem operation. But unfortunately, the Battle of Ardennes, or the Battle of the Bulge as it's known, suddenly took place in December 1944 and stopped the follow-up operation taking place, because there was obviously a very intense battle took place in Ardennes, and a lot of the airborne troops that were going to be engaged in Operation Varsity were involved in that ground battle. Now, I mean, following that, so what happened after the Battle of the Bulge had been completed and we're moving into the winter of 1944-45, it was decided that Operation Varsity would then very seriously be decided upon with regard to date, strategy and everything associated with it. And I don't know how the date was chosen, but the 24th of March 1945 was the day that Eisenhower and Montgomery decided we would go across the Rhine.
Now, how were you briefed?
Well, it was quite comprehensive. We had lots of briefing photographs to study, and they were taken by obviously reconnaissance aircraft flying low over the village of Hamminkeln area in Germany, which is about 7 or 8 miles east of the Rhine. And the pictures were very clear, and we were indicated what targets we were to go for, the troops, what their position was, and their objective in the battle, and largely that was it. We had to virtually memorize a photograph, and any salient points in the area that you could relate to when you arrived at the landing zone.
So, when did you get this briefing?
Well, within about 3 or 4 days before the operation. And that took place at RAF Birch near Colchester. Now, at that time, or plus prior and just after the briefing, we were ferrying, that's E Squadron, speaking of my own squadron, we were ferrying gliders from Downampney to RAF Birch. And therefore, all the gliders concerned, which were 60 in total, were accumulated on the airfield. And also, tug aircraft were flown in to match the gliders which they had to tow.
Were there any accidents in landing all those gliders at...
Not to my knowledge.
When you say ferrying, they were flown?
They were towed. Towed over by, and then we were released and then landed on RAF Birch.
No problem for you?
None at all, no.
So what happened in Alaska? What about secrecy? How important was that, would you say?
Well, it was the whole airfield, and the same went for the other 8 airfields in Essex that comprised the operation. They were completely sealed off, and in no way could you leave the airfield or have any contact with the outside world at all.
And how did you feel in yourself before this operation took place?
Well, obviously we were going into a very dangerous situation, but with the confidence of youth, I wasn't troubled to a great deal. You know, a certain apprehension, but that's about as far as I can recall. Yes.
So, take me through to the next stage. What's the next thing that happened then?
Well, we then come in towards the eve of the operation, the 23rd of March. Then we were given final briefing. We were issued with our...
What happened to the final briefing?
Well, largely to ensure that there had been no change with regard to what was expected as far as enemy positions or enemy troops that could be in the area. It was literally an updated briefing for the last minute. That was the whole idea of it. And at that stage, we were issued with our weapons, all of us.
What weapons were you issued with? What were you going to take?
Well, I had a Browning pistol. Peter Geddes, my co-pilot, he had a rifle. But we also had with us a pit and supply of bombs in the glider that we were responsible for. But the others, largely, they had brain guns, rifles, etc.
Now, when were you introduced to the men you were going to carry? Or did you just find them on the aeroplane, on the glider?
No. We were got up quite early. Of the morning of the operation, and we had a very early breakfast, and then we were taken by transport to the glider area, and we were dropped off in group or in pairs, the pilots, and I was dropped off alongside the hawser. And at that stage, there were a group of airborne troops sitting on the grass and standing around smoking or chatting. And that's the first time I met up with the troops who I was going to take over.
And what were your first impressions of them?
Much older than us. And because we were only about 1920, looked quite young. Several of the troops in past years have said to me that I've met up with, they were amazed. They thought they'd got a couple of school kids come to take them over the Rhine.
And these were men of the Ox and Bucks,
were they? That's right. D Company, 25 Platoon.
It was 25 Platoon.
Yeah, D Company 25 Platoon, that's it. And they were the survivors of one of the first gliders that landed at Pegasus Bridge. There were 10 survivors and 16 replacements.
Now, what were they? Did they look confident, or how did they look to you?
Yes, they looked like very professional soldiers, to be perfectly frank. They looked as though they knew their business all right.
Now, who was the officer, the second lieutenant?
That I can't remember. So I only knew him for the short period of time until we left him on the operation.
Now, was there any particular boarding procedure?
Well, none at all. We just stood aside and they climbed on the glider, chose the seat which they wished to set at the soldiers. And then, having completed that, they hauled aboard a hand cart filled with ammunition and bombs, which obviously they required as fighting troops. And then Peter Geddes and I, we went on board. We chatted with the captain. He had a sergeant with him in charge of the platoon. And generally, we chatted as to what was be expected and what would happen when we reached the landing area.
Now, was there a check routine before you took off? I mean, was there anything you had to do before you took off?
Not with powered aircraft. Obviously, you have lots of check routines, but gliders were fairly basic, almost primitive, I would say.
So anything else before you took off?
No, nothing, as I know. We were sitting quietly, waiting for our turn to leave.
Now, it's still early morning. What time did you take off?
Yeah, I think it was about 7:30. No, it wouldn't have been. It'd be about 7 o'clock. Did it say on there?
Cause it says 7:25.
Yeah, well, that would be about it, yeah.
And that's when they began the takeoff. Now, what was the takeoff procedure? How was it organised?
Well, you had ground staff with Aldis lamps that indicated each combination's turn to take off. And there were 60 of them, as I say, to take off. And we were towed by Dakota aircraft.
And tell us exactly what happened when you went to take off then.
Well, I was about fifth in order of takeoff, and the other four had taken off very, very fast, as you might imagine, with 60 to take off. It had to be done very, very quickly. But I had the misfortune, which I hadn't had before, that as we gathered speed down the runway, the tow rope broke. Now, that was obviously quite dismaying, but I realised I had to clear the runway very quickly with the balance of the combinations behind me waiting to take off.
So you hadn't taken off? I just wanted
no,
to make
this I was still
clear.
On
you
the
were
runway.
Just running along the
fast
runway.
Fast down the runway, that's right.
And was there any problem in getting off quickly or...?
What, you've been taking off?
No, getting out of the way.
Oh, no, what happened? I realised I had to clear the runway, so I spotted ahead of me on the port side. There was a perimeter track leading away, so I just very swiftly, with the aid of brakes, and steered the glider off the main runway, onto the perimeter track, and then slowly come to a standstill.
Who was towing your... Because you actually knew the pilot, because it was actually the squadron commander, wasn't it?
No, he wasn't. He was a squadron leader, but he was just a tug pilot.
Right.
And he happened to be towing my glider. Well, I hadn't met him before that, but we had a chat on the intercom and got to know each other. And we explained, you know, what we do, what our function was, and it was quite a friendly relationship.
And this is
really.
Squadron leader Alex Blythe, from 233 Squadron.
That's him, yeah.
Now, what did you think of him? I mean, what impressions did you get of him?
Well, I didn't know him other than a voice, because he was in the tug and I was in the glider. I hadn't met him. I just he spoke to me on the intercom, and we had a little chat about the operation, what he was going to do and what I was going to do. So a good relationship quickly established, despite the fact I was a sergeant and he was a squadron leader. Immediately he was referring to me as Stan Jarvis, and it was a quite comfortable arrangement, yeah.
So what did the two of you do between you? What did you arrange to do after the tow rope broke?
Well, what happened? Well, after the tow rope broke, naturally I cleared the runway, and then he realised that he had lost the glider because of the loss of pulling effect on his Dakota, and he very, very swiftly applied as much brake as possible and slowed down before he ran out of runway. And then he pulled off on another perimeter track on the port side, and then slowly taxied round the airfield.
So what happened then?
Well, the rest of the gliders then all roared ahead and took off very, very swiftly until the time came that Alex Blythe, Dakota and my horse were the only ones left on the airfield.
Now, was it easy to get a new rope?
No, there were plenty available.
So you'd had one of them fitted?
That's right. We were towed back into position again on the runway, positioned there as we were previously, and then we took off normally without any further incident.
There's no problem at all?
No, not at all. No.
Do you know what time you took off? About how long would it be?
I couldn't.
Half an hour are we talking about?
It might well be. It could be to that order.
Well, you don't know.
I can't honestly remember.
I shouldn't put words in your mouth. No. So, but then there was no problem. Now, were you still in sight of the... of the ones that had gone before you?
Oh yes, the other ones were, but they're way ahead of us, but we were in the wrong position in the actual stream that we intended to be, because we were at the back.